Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymeer Church of Christ.
If you'd like to turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 9, we'll be there in just a few moments as our journey through the land where Jesus walked comes to a conclusion tonight, and I hope this has been something that's been a blessing to you. There are a lot of exciting things going on. I realize with the holiday weekend, there are many who are traveling, and obviously we're praying for those as they're traveling, and thankful for the extra time maybe to spend with family and to get to do some things. But there are some exciting things taking place here. This morning we had our elders present Bibles to our first graders. And if you've noticed, we have a lot of young children that are here that are a part of Bible Connection that will be here as part of youth troop events. And it's very encouraging to see how excited they are to participate. I hope that you'll take the time to tell one of those first graders how much you appreciate them. That means the world to them to see that there's someone who looks at them and really is encouraged by them. I think that would just be a great thing to do. You'll also see some of these postcards there are some more that are out at this exit. We almost ran out today, but postcards for our parenting seminar on September the 19th. That's going to be from 1 to 6 p.m. As Chris mentioned, we still are looking for help with childcare, but the good news is you don't have to be in a room with a bunch of small children for 5 straight hours. We wouldn't do that to you. We're not just going to put you in there and lock you in. We sort of have 2 shifts that we'll be going through. One group will work from 1 to 3, and then the next from 3 to 4:45. At 4:45, we'll just have a meal together with all the families who are there. We already have over 60 individuals that will join us for this workshop. And so we want to be prepared, especially because there will be some advertising being done in the community. And we might have people for the first time come to our building for this seminar. And so if that's the case, we want to be prepared to let them know that we're prepared for them and that we care enough to be ready to take care of their children while they attend the seminar. So I hope we can be planning for that and be prayerful about that. You'll also notice if you walk down this hallway, the bulletin board with our classes for Sunday morning and Wednesday night Bible classes. Chad's put together a neat, informative way for us to keep track of the classes that are there. And on that board, you'll see about our college class that is just beginning, and Chad is teaching that. And that's a tremendous way, if you are in college or 20-something age, to stay connected, to connect with a group of people, and also to be part of our church family. And so if you know someone who'd be interested in that class, please let them know about it. That's going to be a great blessing to us. We want to continue to remember in prayer the family of Ruth Brown, as we've already mentioned, and all those who are in need of our prayers. It's hard to read through the Bible, especially the New Testament, without running into references to Jerusalem. And it's probably hard for us to overestimate the importance that city would have had to the Jews, especially in the time of Jesus. And to walk there today is incredibly fascinating. It's fascinating on a lot of levels. Number one, it's fascinating because you have a small city where there are so many different faiths that are all there and are all coexisting. So when we went, our tour guide is a member of the Greek Orthodox Church. And we had a driver who was a devout Muslim who was celebrating Ramadan while we were there. And so you had both of them working together. Anytime we would go into a different site, a different place of Jerusalem, we would encounter different people from various backgrounds. When you drove through the Jewish quarter, you would see the Jewish families that were there. If you were driving through on Friday, you would see a lot of them with big bags of groceries because they were getting ready for Sabbath and they weren't going to leave their home to go shopping on Saturday. You could even see them walking, and it was interesting just to watch. You would see, and if a family was walking down the road, you would see a father and a son up front, and you would see the mother and any daughters walking behind them. It's kind of interesting. Even just in the way they walk down the road, you see their faith reflected. You would see among the Orthodox Jews there the sideburns that were grown out and that were curly down the side, even from very young Jewish males that were there. At the same time, you have not only the Jewish quarter, but you also have a Muslim quarter there. You have a Christian quarter and an Armenian quarter. So here you've got four different areas, and you can see the guideline. You can see when you cross one street into another section. It's fascinating. And there's also a lot of tension about who owns certain sites and certain areas, because you have many people there who feel a pull and a claim to certain areas of Jerusalem. They're even strict about who cleans up certain areas, certain streets, and areas around the holy sites. As our guide told us, the old saying is, you clean it today and you claim it tomorrow. And so they have very strict guidelines about who's in charge and who's responsible for this certain area. And so it's fascinating as you walk through to see that. I also mentioned the commercialization that was interesting. I think this next slide shows us a picture, kind of an overview of the city that's there. And if you look at the next one, when you walk down some of these alleyways in our next slide, you kind of see sort of the close quarters you'd be walking through. This is right before you get into a lot of the tourist areas. This is where we were walking through and just looking at all the shops, and we saw a big Crimson Tide sign outside one of the shops, and they were trying to get Alabama fans to come in there. Some of you might have appreciated that. I think they figured out a lot of people from the south like to travel to Jerusalem, and they're wanting to get their attention. And so anything, you had all kind of SEC football teams represented in Jerusalem, trying to get you in the door. Of course, if you talk to any salesman, no matter what time of day it is, you're always their first sale of the day. They say, you're my first sale of the day. I'll make a deal for you. You're the first sale. And so you're dealing with all kinds of bargaining that takes place in the shops, and a lot of commercialization, even commercialization about very serious topics and religious sites. You can visit in the temple grounds, a fascinating experience. If you look at the next slide, this is not in the temple grounds itself. This is in the Western Wall, or what's sometimes called the Wailing Wall. They would prefer to call it a Western Wall there. This is the part of the temple grounds that the Jewish people have control over. The Muslims have control of the temple grounds itself, where the temple once sat, although we don't know exactly where that is. But the Wailing Wall has some pieces of wall that would have been part of sort of Solomon's temple, would have been connected with that. Now, obviously, a lot of that's been rebuilt, but if you go downstairs, there's kind of a little historical tour you can take and see pieces of that rock that have been preserved there. We went to the Western Wall on a bar mitzvah day, where you had a lot of boys that were being taken there as part of their bar mitzvah to be presented to rabbis. This made it very interesting because there was a celebration about every 5 minutes for someone else with a lot of music, and sort of a group would parade by celebrating one individual, and then it would die down for about 5 minutes and then another would. If you're familiar with the Western Wall, if you look at the next slide, you get kind of a close-up of putting prayers in the wall, thinking that this connection to the temple is very important, and so you'll have prayers that are placed there and people praying at the wall. There's a section, as in the synagogues, there would be a section for women and for men, and so our group split up and the ladies got to visit the ladies section, and we got to visit the section with the men that are there. You got to walk around and see many who were reading the Torah, who were reading what we would think of as parts of the Law of Moses in Hebrew. And it was fascinating to listen to that being read aloud. Many of them would do that. They'd rock back and forth as they read. And I wondered why that was. And we asked our tour guide. And he said, because when you're reading, they have such a great respect for it, they don't want to fall asleep while reading. And so they'll kind of rock back and forth. That motion helps them stay focused, and it keeps them from becoming drowsy. And if you've ever stayed up late studying for a test, you understand how that can happen when you fall asleep. And they don't want to do that, of falling asleep reading God's Word. And so it's interesting to see that side of it. If you go to the temple grounds itself, you will see here, and this is a model that we'll talk about in just a minute, but it's a good illustration of what we would think of if we're trying to reconstruct the temple grounds and where Solomon's temple would have been. Now, the area around the temple ground now, when you enter into it, is under Muslim control. They have built the Dome of the Rock. When you see those pictures of Jerusalem and you see that golden dome, that's what you're seeing there. The Dome of the Rock is a mosque that's right there on the temple area. And it's not just one mosque that's been built. There are several on the temple grounds. And that is so that if someone were to go in and try to build something, they would have to tear down one of those mosques. And so it's almost like a staking your territory and saying, this is ours. Now, the interesting thing about the temple and the temple area is that you have traditions that have ascribed this as being on Mount Moriah. And if you think about Mount Moriah and you think about the Old Testament account of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, again, we don't know exact locations of where that took place, but you're looking at the general area of where the temple is, where Abraham binds Isaac and goes to sacrifice him. And then you have the Jews who would have respected that temple that was built there, built by Solomon and then eventually destroyed and then rebuilt. And then when you get to Herod's rule in the New Testament, Herod goes and sort of builds it back up, and every year seems like was adding something new and fancy and ornate in the temple grounds. And so you have a group of Jews that really respect that area. Then you have those who are Christians who would read through the temple and think about, this is where Jesus went. And this is where he was taken before when Mary and Joseph presented him at the temple. And this is where you'd have Peter preaching in the early church as he heals a man who was lame. And he's preaching to everybody about that in Acts chapters 3 and 4 and everything that takes place there. And so you have Christians identifying with that. According to the Muslim view, they believe this to be the place where Muhammad ascended to heaven on his horse. And so it's sort of like saying, well, you have your belief about this, but, you know, we have our belief that this took place there. So you've got the tension, and you can kind of feel it. I never felt unsafe while I was on the trip, but I did feel tension when you were on the Temple Mount. You may even have seen some video that's been making the rounds on Facebook about some things that happen on the Temple Mount. There's a group of Jews who are Orthodox Jews and who would really like to rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount. And they have made no secret of that. It's just sort of a sect of Judaism that's there. And every day there's a group of them that visit the temple. And they visit the temple grounds. They've made no secret that they want to claim that land. As a result of that, the Muslims who were there praying and studying the Quran in the temple grounds are on high alert. And whenever that group comes in, that group is led by a guard to walk through. And this other group will sort of, as a way to respond, will kind of walk around and chant a praise of Allah around this Jewish group that's touring. And I say that because some of you may have seen video of that, and it looks very strange because you have these policemen who are walking through and not doing anything. What they're doing is making sure that there might be calling back and forth, and there might be chanting and maybe taunting back and forth, but that nothing physical begins to happen. So it's really an interesting situation. Everybody's right there all together. And this model that you can see there as well is a fascinating, I don't know if you can see a bit of the scale with the individuals who are in the background. The next picture shows another portion of this Jerusalem model you can look at. But it's a fascinating way to try to envision what the city would have been like in the time of Christ. Now, there are a couple of different thoughts about where the temple was in the Temple Mount area. And you can find different guys that believe different things. But it's interesting to me that you have a model like this to give you an example of what life was like. But at the same time, something as significant as the temple, we can't know just exactly where it was. And we don't have the temple that's still standing. In AD 70, you had the destruction of Jerusalem, and then it was as early as the 3rd century that you had Muslim groups taking over the Temple Mount. And so we don't know that. And I think there's probably, this is just my opinion, a providential reason for that. Because it would be very easy for us to get caught up in making the temple into an idol. I think that may be why we don't always have some of the artifacts we wish we would have, because human beings tend to hold those up as objects of worship. And the Jews certainly had a hard time seeing past the temple to the God that had commanded them to build it. But one thought I had over and over again in Jerusalem, as you go to these places, and as you walk through some of the sites that are there, and it's hard to mention all of them, but you have these churches that have been built over these historic sites. And as Eflagard Smith mentions in his book, Meeting God in Holy Places, there are many times you want to see something out of the Bible, but there's a church in the way. And boy, I read that and that just hit me, that idea of people wanting to see something, but there's a church in the way. And how many times are we in the way of what people want to see from God? And it can be easy to be negative about that. There are some interesting benefits that happen. One of those near the pool of Bethesda, where you read about the waters being stirred and the man being healed by Jesus there. We went to the cathedral that's been built near it, St. Anne's, that's been built right by it. And as we walked in the cathedral, it was beautiful. The acoustics were incredible. And we were the only group in there. And one of the things we would do in these different places that had incredible acoustics is we would just sing. It was something just to sing in the midst of a cathedral. So we were singing a couple of songs. And then another tour group came in. And they just asked us, can we sing with you? And so we said, sure. And we sang another well-known hymn. It may have been Amazing Grace. And then they had a request. And if you have ever sung in a chorus in a school that was affiliated with the Church of Christ, you'll understand what's happening next. Because they said, can we sing The Lord Bless You and Keep You? And if you've ever been in a chorus, it doesn't matter if you went to a Christian college in Texas or Arkansas or Tennessee. Every Christian school chorus, it seems like, sang The Lord Bless You and Keep You at the end. I've been to some chorus groups where they said, if you've been in any chorus associated with the Church of Christ, come up and we'll sing The Lord Bless You and Keep You. Because they just know that's what's there. So we sang The Lord Bless You and Keep You. We had the sevenfold Amen afterward. I mean, it was really powerful. And the leader of the other group, as soon as that was done, turned around to us and he said, are you from the Church of Christ? And we said, yes, we are. And he said, we are too. I knew it. I knew it. And so it was amazing. You know, you had a little connection there. We got to spend some time with that group. But all of this aside, I want us just to focus on what Jerusalem meant and what it means to us. And to ask ourselves, are there times where the church, without meaning to, can get in the way? And people want to see something from God, but there's a church that's in the way. We first encounter Jerusalem in the Old Testament. It's called the City of David. The reason it's called the City of David is because that's where David moved his capital to. Now, David's life is interesting because he's anointed all the way back in 1 Samuel as king, and yet he doesn't start reigning until years later. For a while, Saul's after him. David sort of develops his own private army, a group of people that are sort of under his leadership. And then after Saul's death, it's not just an easy cruise to the throne, but David reigns in Hebron for about 7.5 years. And in 2 Samuel 5, that's when we read about David moving in to Jerusalem. He takes Israel to war against the Jebusites. Now, the Jebusites were confident that they would emerge victorious, but they were defeated. Remember, David is a powerful warrior, and that's how he really makes his name and his reputation. And so he takes them in, he defeats them, and it has made David's place of where his palace is, his capital. He continues to expand on it and build it. And then we continue reading in David's life that he had it in his mind to build the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, but it wasn't in God's plan for David to do it. It was in God's plan for his son Solomon to do it. And so we read about Solomon's temple. It was really the temple dedicated to God, but if you're trying to distinguish it from the rebuilt temple that comes later on, we think of that as Solomon's temple. I want us to just remember what it was like when the Israelites were leaving Egypt And you had this tabernacle, this tent that would be set up. And it was a way that a holy God lived among an unholy people. If we don't have a good concept of sin and the purity of God, it'll be hard for us to understand this. But you have a holy God who needs a way to dwell among a people who are far from holy. And the tabernacle did that. It allowed a place where God's presence could be among them as they moved. Well, now they're in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the capital here. And so Solomon builds a temple. And the temple, built according to God's instructions, is a place where God dwells among his people. And so you have this incredible King David that in many ways is going to influence what people think about the Messiah that's coming. He's going to come from David's line, from this mighty king, and that's who they're going to be looking for. And that all happens in Jerusalem. But later, the temple, like many of the church buildings that would be over a site in modern Jerusalem, started to get in the way of people listening to God. The temple was a way people could interact with him, but it became a distraction. And so when we start reading some of the writings of the prophets, we read, for example, in Jeremiah's time, he's predicting that an invasion is going to come, that Jerusalem is going to be toppled, it's going to be taken over, but people aren't listening. They're not listening because in their minds, hey, the temple's still standing. The temple's still here. We've got the temple right here. How is anything going to happen to us? Look what we've got. And so if you're reading through, like in Jeremiah 7:4, he says, "Do not trust in deceptive words, like this is the temple of the Lord." In other words, he's saying, what I'm telling you is true. Don't be distracted by the fact that the temple is still standing. Listen to the message of God. And yet we know from history that didn't happen. And so you have the invasion that comes in. And you have the Babylonians coming in and taking Judah and everything that happens after that. After the Babylonians have been overcome by the Persian kingdom that comes in, then you have groups that come and rebuild the temple. And so Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah, we start reading about them, and they build the temple back up. And then we get to, from the city of David, the destination of Jesus. See, Jerusalem is a place where Jesus, in his ministry, was aimed at from the very beginning. Joseph and Mary took Jesus to Jerusalem in order for him to be presented at the temple. And so if we're reading through the Gospels, we see that Simeon takes Jesus in his arms and prays a prayer of thanksgiving that he's seen a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to Israel. And he says these words to Mary. He says, "Behold, this child is appointed for the fall and rising of many in Israel and for a sign that is opposed, and a sword will pierce through your own soul also, so that the thoughts from many hearts will be revealed." Seems almost like a mixed message. First of all, he says, we've got a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to Israel. Both Jews and Gentiles, here he is. He is being presented at the temple. But he tells Mary, you know, this is going to be a fall for many in Israel. A sword will pierce through your own soul. There's going to be some challenges here. And Jesus understood that from the very beginning. And so we get to Luke chapter 9 in verse 51. When the days were approaching for his ascension, he was determined to go to Jerusalem. That tells us so much about what happens next in Jesus' ministry. He set his face to Jerusalem. Maybe what some of your translations would say. I like the way one author interpreted it. He set his face like flint to go to Jerusalem. He was hardened, and this is what he was going to do. And it didn't matter the times the apostles would try to discourage him. Jesus knew what was going to happen there. It was his destination to go to Jerusalem. And when he comes to Jerusalem, he finds out that people are at the temple and people are distracted. They're distracted by a lot of things. We see Jesus famously turning over the tables of the money changers in the temple. People who had made a business off of what you might call a predatory salesmanship. They would take people who couldn't provide for themselves or were from out of town and say, "No, you've got to change to this kind of money, this kind of currency. We'll sell what you need for sacrifices, but we'll make an obscene profit." And Jesus comes in and says that has made the place that was a house of worship a den of thieves. And he starts turning over tables. And by the way, if our picture of Jesus doesn't take into account the fact that he grew up as the son of a carpenter or a mason who would work in building things and was big enough and strong enough to take these tables and to turn them over and to drive out the money changers and to be standing there and to discourage anybody else from trying to set them back up. I mean, the picture we get is that Jesus makes an incredible impact. It would have been intimidating to see that, because Jesus is so upset about what's happened in the place that was designed for worship to God. In Luke 21, Jesus is watching all the rich people put in their contributions to the temple. And instead of focusing on all those who were dropping so many coins into those receptacles that probably would have made a lot of noise, he notices a widow who has two small coins. And I think that that's as much an indictment on the people around her as it is a commendation of this widow. Not only is she giving everything that she has, but she's among all these people who are giving these huge donations to the temple, but no one's taking care of her. No one's taking care of someone who only has two small coins worth just a fraction of what everybody else had to live on. And she's not being cared for. People are distracted. They might be giving a lot at the temple, but they're missing the point of taking care of people who are in need. And right after the widow's offering, people start looking at the temple and talking about how it's adorned with noble stones. It seemed that every year Herod would have something else that was golden or that was impressive added to the temple. And there were times when Jesus' followers, towards the end of Matthew, start looking at the temple and marveling at it. And that's when Jesus talks about the destruction that's coming, where not one stone will be left upon another. They've been distracted by the temple. They were losing sight as to what was really important. It was a destination of Jesus. And when we get to the very end of the Bible, we see it as a vision of heaven. The heavenly city is described in this way in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 22. You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. When we sing about marching to Zion, not only does that have a physical correspondence in Scripture, but also a spiritual way that's used. There's a heavenly Jerusalem. Or John would say in Revelation 21, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Why would John use those words? Why would the Spirit inspire those words, a new Jerusalem? Because if we think of the power that was connected for Israel with Jerusalem and what that meant to them, he's saying now we're not talking about a physical Jerusalem. We're not talking about a place where God dwells among an unholy people here on earth in his temple. And when Jesus comes and when Jesus is crucified and when you see everything that's happening there and that curtain in the temple is torn from top to bottom because now God has a new way of dwelling among his people through his Son, you have this time where God could spend with his people. Now it's a heavenly city. It's a heavenly Jerusalem. We'll be dwelling with God, but it's not going to be on this physical plane that we think of as a physical city. He said it's like a new Jerusalem. And again, when we're in Revelation, we're seeing the limitations of human language to describe just heavenly, incredible picture. But I can just almost imagine John writing out, it's so glorious, it's like a new Jerusalem. It's not even what the old Jerusalem is. It's better even than that, this new Jerusalem, a vision of heaven. And so the question is, when I think about this new Jerusalem, this heavenly city, are there any distractions that are keeping me from focusing on where I'm going or keeping others from seeing the promise of God? Do I know where my destination is the way Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem? Do I understand the power of what it means to think about a new heavens and a new earth provided by God? And am I communicating that vision to other people? Are they able to see that? Are they able to see a God who wants to be with his creation? Or am I getting in the way? Is the church getting in the way? Is the way I'm living, or the things I'm saying, or the attitudes I have at work, the way I carry myself at school, the way I act to people in my neighborhood, is that getting in the way? Is that obscuring the vision? Am I somehow distracting people from what truly matters? I think that's a challenging question. It's challenging for us to consider if our own vision is clearly aimed at God, but it's also good for us to consider, are we getting in the way? Whether we mean to or not, are people looking for something meaningful, but the church is in the way, but Christians are in the way, but I'm in the way? It's interesting to see when you walk through Jerusalem how many groups will take pilgrimages there. I think it's a great place to go. I think you ought to go there, but I wouldn't call it a pilgrimage. Because we see in Acts 17, Paul reminds a group of Athenians that were focused on temples built to very different pagan gods, that God doesn't dwell in a temple made with human hands. In other words, there was a time when the tabernacle was the way God dwelt among His people. There was a time the temple was the way God dwelt among His people. But the way God dwells among us changed when He sent His Son. And so we're not looking for a pilgrimage to a temple that's there. We're not looking to revere objects that may have been touched by servants of God or things that they claim to say, this is where so-and-so lived. I think it's fascinating. I think it's interesting. It strengthens our faith, but that's not our focus. We're not making pilgrimages there. We're asking, what does God want for my life? I don't need to go to a temple to be able to relate to God. It's the power of the gospel. And so it's interesting to see that even today, there can be distractions. I thought of that as I thought about the tension around the Temple Mount. The groups that want to lay claim to a piece of land, and I understand the significance in their minds, but I just want to push back on that a little bit and say, wait a minute, it's not about a tract of land. It's not about one specific place, because everything changed when God sent His Son into the world. And now, no matter where we are, Jesus was not only the hope for Israel, but also from the very beginning, we see a hope of revelation to the Gentiles, to all nations. No matter where we live, no matter what our past has been, we can have, whether we've ever even been to the earthly Jerusalem before, we can have the promise of the new Jerusalem, the new heavens and the new earth that are beyond anything we can explain or imagine. Let's just make sure we don't get in the way. And so tonight, if you want to make that vision a reality for your life, if you want to be able to rejoice the same way John was when he described this incredible city that was coming down, this idea that there would be an eternity with God, you can have that as a reality. You can decide to become a child of God, to put Christ on in baptism, to live with that assurance. Or it may be that you need to come back and refocus on where your destination is. Maybe you've been in the way for someone else and you want to get out of the way and point to God. If there's any way we can help you, please come as we stand and as we all sing together.